The lectionary's juxtaposition of those two texts that Jack and Barbara just read betrays what Stephen Fowles once called a wicked sense of humor on someone's part. The James passage, as you may recall, begins with an assertion of the fundamental incompatibility of faith in Christ with partiality in human relationships, and goes on to list in ways in which believers typically display such favoritism. And then in Mark, Jesus seems to engage in the very sort of partiality that James warns against, refusing to heal a very sick child because she and her mother are Gentiles, outsiders. What are we going to do with that paradox? Well, let's begin with Mark, with the second reading. Our modern sensibilities bristle a bit here at this story, I suspect. It describes an awkward moment made memorable by what seems to be Jesus' rude rebuff of the woman's request for help. Here, as one scholar notes, at least for an instant, Jesus seems to get caught with his compassion down. A Gentile woman comes to him pleading for healing for her daughter, and Jesus puts her off with this painful proverb about Jews, whom he likens to children at the table, and Gentiles, whom he dismisses as dogs. It's not right to feed the dogs with the food intended for the children, he says. But she will not relent. If I'm a dog, then treat me as a dog and at least let me have the crumbs from the children's table. She's not angry. Perhaps she's heard it all before, but she is as persistent as she is wise. And because of her unusual but gripping claim on Jesus' compassion, her plea is heard and her prayer is answered. Many commentators have proffered theories to try to explain Jesus' uncharacteristic and abrupt response to this woman. In the end, though, it's all conjecture. No one knows why he responded as he did. Most scholars do agree that in focusing on Jesus' initial response, we may miss the point of his ultimate response. This Gentile woman chides Jesus into changing his mind, into understanding that his mission extends beyond the house of Israel. And in response, Jesus begins to widen his circle of compassion and concern and hospitality. And from this moment on, there's no stopping that widening imperative. It's important, therefore, to note that this woman is not a contestant with Jesus in this story. She is not his antagonist. She is in league with the very interior of his mission and ministry, connected to its movement. She simply presses him to claim the fullness of that mission. Now, there's much to learn from this woman whose faith is a lively, vigorous, insisting power that doesn't give up easily. We sometimes equate faith, I think, with passive acceptance of a doctrine or quiet acquiescence or calm that consoles us in a time of sadness and loss. And it can be those things, but less often do we think about faith as an aggressive, insisting power, as a force that has the capacity to influence the very mind of God. And yet this woman's faith was both of those things. She had a deep-seated confidence that Jesus could do what she was asking him to do. Indeed, that it was his nature to save and to heal and to cast out demons. And that he had to grant her request, even if she was a Gentile and speaking out of place. This is a story about tenacity of faith. There's even a more important point to this story, however, because fundamentally this is a story about God's grace and the widening circles of those who receive it. Jesus' initial response to the woman was wrapped up in his own understanding of his mission, as first and foremost to his own people, the Jews. Jesus never apologized for that fact. He was a Jew sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But in this woman's insistent reminder of the breadth and the nature of his purpose, Jesus began to sense the true expanse of that mission. Her persistence and Jesus' ultimate embrace of her request serve as a reminder to the church, I think. One of the recurring questions the church is asked to address is the question about its mission. Whom do we serve? Christine Chikoyan says it all boils down largely to one beginning point. We gather first to take care of the flock, to take care of ourselves, and to take care of our own, because we know that within the community of faith, the needs we bear and the burdens we carry are likely to be met with compassion and grace, because we believe that here we will encounter Christ himself. We need not apologize for focusing on the needs of this congregation and of those who come to be a part of who we are. That is why we're here, after all. But at the same time, the persistent voices of others beyond these walls compels us to embrace a mission beyond the near, the comfortable, and the obvious. Jesus' widening mission to the Gentiles did not negate his mission to his own, any more than our commitment and mission to the world negate or diminish the ministries that happen within these walls. We start here, but like the ripples that then move ever outward from the stone that is tossed into the waters, the ripples of faith and service always move us outward from the center. What we learn along the way is that it's not a matter of competition. It's not a matter of ministries to our own versus ministries to the world out there. Indeed, our ministries to our own are precisely to equip us eventually to take the faith of love and compassion and peace into the world, ministries of healing and wholeness out there as well as in here. The model for such movement is none other than Jesus himself. And the love at the core is none other than the love of God. The story of the Gentile woman and her tenacious pursuit of grace is thus also a story about a God who wants to share such grace with all the children of earth, and of a Christ who, despite his seeming reluctance at first, opened the door for such grace to be extended to the Gentiles, which is to say, to you and me. It's the story of Jesus, who was moved by the earnest petitions of a young mother in need. It's the story of a God who, despite our own unworthiness, still meets us across a table at which boundless grace is shared so that it may be taken into an often graceless world. That's our calling. That is our mission. It's what we are about. And that's also what our passage from the letter to James affirms, albeit with a more precise focus. It, too, is about a widening imperative in mission. But James is not concerned about expanding mission in general. He takes specific aim at how the church treats the poor. He decries the church's age-old partiality to those of means and its disregard for those who have so little. It's a hard word to hear because James calls us to examine the narrowness of our graciousness in light of Christ's ever-widening call and claim on us, and to think beyond present practice to the way Christ calls us to live. Parker Palmer calls the chasm between what is and what should be, between the way things are and the way they're meant to be, he calls them a tragic gap. There are many gaps in our day, but none more tragic than the chasm between those who have and those who have not, between those who know the privileges of the inside and those who live on the outside. It's everywhere for us to see. From the stark dichotomy of faces we see around this village to the racially charged debate on immigration in this nation. Palmer says the church's calling is to stand in the gap between what is and what God intends, and to minister to move us from one to the other. The Presbyterian pastor Trace Haythorne spoke once of the widening grace we are called to embody, sharing as he did a story of one who stood in that gap and who embraced the expanding imperative of God's claim. It's a story of a man named Sandor Tesler. Tesler left Hungary for the United States after escaping from a concentration camp with his family in the early part of World War II. He was trained as a textile worker, so he made his way to Spartanburg, South Carolina, along a center of textile industry in this country, and later took ownership of a textile factory there. In the 1950s, shortly after Brown versus Board of Education came through, Mr. Tesler became anxious as he saw the rise and the reemergence of the Ku Klux Klan, and as he heard the racist rhetoric and the fear-mongering around him begin to intensify. He recognized it from his days in Europe, and he could not simply ignore it for the sake of business. He went to his foreman and he asked where the racial tensions were most hostile in that area. The foreman replied that he wasn't sure exactly where the worst was, but it couldn't get much worse than up around Kings Mountain, North Carolina, just across the North Carolina-South Carolina border. So Mr. Tesler announced that day that he would be building a new factory in Kings Mountain. When word got out of his plans, the mayor of Kings Mountain, the white mayor of Kings Mountain, came to see Mr. Tesler, asking if he planned to hire white workers. And Mr. Tesler told him to recruit the best workers he could find, and if they were good enough, he would hire them. Soon after that, he met with the black pastor of a large African-American church there, and he expressed his hope to Mr. Tesler that he would hire black workers. And again, Mr. Tesler encouraged him to find the best workers he could, and if they were good enough, he would hire them. In the end, Sandor Tesler hired 16 new employees, 8 of them white, 8 of them African-American. In the mill, there was one bathroom, one set of showers, one water fountain. After initial introductions and a tour of the plant were complete, one white worker asked, "Is this going to be some kind of integrated plant?" Mr. Tesler replied, "You're going to be paid twice as much as any other textile worker in this area. You can work with us here in the way we work, or you can go somewhere else. Are there any other questions?" And there were none. Well, several months later, the plant had grown in production such that a new group of employees was needed. And so they hired another group, 8 and 8. And after their tour, the same question was raised by one of the white workers: "Is this some kind of integrated plant?" And this time, the foreman replied, "You're being paid twice as much as any other textile worker in the area. You can work with us here in the way we work, or you can go somewhere else. Are there other questions?" Says Trace Haythorne, "Because Sandor Tesler dared to stand in that tragic gap, an entire industry was integrated." James calls us not to choose between rich and poor, not to choose between black and white, not to choose between young and old, or between developed world and developing world, not to choose between free and imprisoned, gay or straight, sick or healthy, naked or clothed, hungry or fed. In the end, these are all false dichotomies, for we are all children of God. James calls us to stand with the cross of Jesus Christ, to take up residence in the gap between what is and what should be. Like Jesus, in the presence of that persistent Gentile woman, we may be uncomfortable at first with such a suggestion. We may hesitate. But if we listen, we may come to see that standing with him means discovering what he discovered, that our mission is wider than we had figured, and if we trust it, is capable of building a bridge across every kind of gap.